Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Poncek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor on the markets team.
This week on the show, there's no denying it, we're in a healthcare crisis, as disheartening as it may be. And you could also say that we're in an economic and a market crisis. Well, our guest actually coined the term crisis alpha, and the strategy she runs is up 7% this year. She'll explain what crisis alpha actually is and how to capture it in times like these.
And as always, we will close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. And please do, if you see something crazy in markets, give us a call on the podcast hotline at 646-324-3490 or tweet to us at podcasts and let us know the craziest thing you saw. And maybe we'll play your voicemail or mention your tweet on the air. Well, let's introduce a new voice here. First time on the show. Very excited to have her. As you pointed out, she is an expert in trend following using managed futures. In fact, wrote the book on it, or at least co-wrote the book Trend Following with Managed Futures, The Search for Crisis Alpha. She is the chief research strategist at Alpha Simplex Group, teaches at MIT in her spare time, and very excited to get her take on these markets. Her name is Katie Kaminsky. Katie, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here today.
I wanted to ask about sort of how the trend following, especially I believe it's the Alpha Simplex Managed Futures strategy that Sarah was referring to. It's up like about 7 or 8% this year. I was reading a note you wrote about sort of the process of trend following during this bear market in stocks that we've seen this year. And I guess you wrote a little bit about how the signals, the cross-asset signals from, say, the bond market and the commodities market, copper and oil especially, were sort of signaling a risk-off environment a lot earlier than stocks, at least before stocks peaked towards the end of February there. But I'm just curious how it all sort of fits together, if you could kind of dissect for us the returns in that fund, how it's able to do so well in this type of environment.
So the concept of crisis alpha opportunities are opportunities gained during periods of market stress or crisis. Strategies like trend following are specifically designed to constantly measure where markets are going and how things are changing across a wide range of methodologies. And what we find is that we move as the markets move. So as markets move in different directions, we're constantly adjusting and following where markets go. And so in the moments when there's a lot of uncertainty or there's a lot of stress in the markets, it turns out that people tend to be much more polarized in their actions for both either behavioral reasons or for the fact that they may be driven into action based on risk management and other typical institutional protocols. So the key thing that we are following and what's different about us is that we're much more technical in nature and that we're actually looking at where the market's going as opposed to why it's going somewhere. And that means that we're listening to the markets and seeing where they are pointing. So if I think about what happened earlier this year, especially January, what was very ominous to me and was giving a little pause was just how are trend following signals and how trend following in general started to see a growing apprehension, not in the equity markets, but more so in the other periphery markets, which were starting to price in some of the uncertainty and some of the potential impacts of a potential pandemic.
So speaking of this apprehension, Katie, the last time I saw you was early March. It seems like a lifetime ago because we were actually face-to-face in person. Doesn't happen anymore. I believe it was on March 6th. And at the time, the S&P had fallen 12%. And little did anyone know that from that point, we still had roughly 25% or more to go. We would also all be entering stay-at-home orders. Businesses would be shutting. And at the time, you expressed that apprehension. And around the same period, you also authored a report. And within it, you said the market smells like skunk, precisely for those reasons that other asset classes were signaling caution. And it makes me think, I mean, if the market, quote unquote, smelled a skunk then, well, then what does it smell now? Because, I mean, you look at oil prices this past week, which dropped below $20 a barrel for WTI again. And at the same time, we haven't really seen bond prices react all that much. But meanwhile, we've just seen equity markets turn around to the upside pretty forcefully.
Exactly. And what's interesting for us is that we saw tremendous trends in the cross asset space. So there were tremendous opportunities in fixed income, short energies, short industrial metals, long precious metals. The currency market has been a little bit more of a back and forth in all of this situation. But in general, the trends that we were seeing were relatively strong, much stronger than the typical amount of trend that you would see in a time where people are not concerned. And this is why these strategies actually do very well in these environments, is that during periods of fear or distress, people are much more coordinated in how they behave. And prices, as a result, can also move in a much more coordinated way, which means that a particular strategy that's actually measuring and monitoring these trends can actually capture them. So I often think about our positioning as an aggregate estimate or view of what the market thinks and where the market's going. So if I take a look back in January at the beginning of this, what was concerning to me is I saw a lot of strength in terms of a lot of bullish signals for fixed income, you know, kind of in some sense hesitation about the equity markets. I also saw a lot of strength in terms of short positions in things like energies. And as you know, oftentimes energies fall with equities, but don't recover as much. And so we saw all of these type of signs and strengthening, especially in flight to safety trades in terms of the cross assets that we monitor, which was indicative that half of the things we were looking at were looking a little ominous and the equity markets were yet to fall. Asian markets were a little bit weaker, but as we saw markets fall out in February into March, then the theme became coordinated, and it was very much a theme of crisis. And since that point, we saw that continue throughout March. Our signals have gone from being very cautiously optimistic about equities to cautiously pessimistic, not in size, but definitely right now, the way we're thinking about things, because you asked about positioning, if I take a look at how trends signals are looking right now, there's definitely a very cautious view on equities, cautious and slightly negative.
Yeah, I'm sure everyone right now is having to make very difficult decisions. And when you say that the stance currently, at least regarding equities, is cautiously pessimistic, can you maybe walk us through the evolution of the strategy, maybe from the end of January to the point at which we get to this point now where we've had a nice rebound off of the lows and the strategy is pessimistic? I know it changes quite often, but can you maybe give us a sense of how the strategy did change throughout time as markets were moving up until this point?
Yeah, I will run through how the strategy had moved, but then at the end, I'll maybe give some overall view in terms of what could be driving this. So I'll start with, at the beginning of the year, it was quite interesting because after a year that was so phenomenally good for the equity markets last year, things were looking good. Bond markets had been more range bound and reverted somewhat in December. So it was really looking like a very pro-equity market environment. I know growth estimates were a little bit more muted than the prior year, but in general, the risk on theme had grown a lot, and we'd seen that in EM currencies, we'd seen that in equities. But then later in the month and around mid-month in January, as people started to notice some of the things that were going on in Asia, we noticed that our potential signals in fixed income started actually to tick up. Our short view on energy started to grow. And then as we had sort of an initial hiccup at the end of January, we started to pick up some potential concern, not in U.S. equity markets, but in some of the cross asset markets. And what was interesting is that you started to get to a position which looked very hedged. So it was long equities, long fixed income, short energy. Now, if you think about that, that's really a hedged position. It's almost like a no position in the sense that you're kind of, if equities go down, you have things that might go up in terms of your positioning. So that continued in through the month of February. So February 19th was the peak before the Great Fall. And what's been interesting about that is that all of the other signals that we were seeing in other asset classes just extended during these periods of time. So the short energy trade grew strength. We also saw fixed income positively responding to that. So for us, it was really about a somewhat hedged position. So trend following an average was roughly flat for the month of February, which I think is relatively spectacular given the type of moves that we saw. Then in March, as we were seeing this move continue, we were getting out of equity markets and trend following signals were reducing exposure to equities down to an almost neutral to very low position. And we saw continued gains in fixed income as well as commodity markets.
Katie, I'd love if you could sort of explain for us some of the signals that define a trend in your strategies. You know, is it as simple as something like a moving average? You know, I imagine there's a lot of complex math involved, but what are some of the sort of cornerstones of identifying a trend that the strategy uses?
So the key approach to trend following is about taking many different technical methodologies and using those to create some sort of score or vote in terms of the direction of an individual market. So this requires you to parameterize how much data you're going to use and what methodology you're going to use in terms of measuring the strength of that particular trend. What we tend to do and what many in the space tend to do is we use a wide range of different methodologies. Some using more technical, simple terms like moving averages and breakout signals, and others to as complicated as drawing from the machine learning literature and trying to do things a little bit more nonlinearly. So overall, I tend to explain a trend following system is really similar to a voting system. You have many different models with different time horizons in terms of how much data they're using, and they all come together in aggregate to vote on where the market is going. So if you think about what we're really trying to do, we're taking in all this data from the markets, which, as you know, if you look at a week and you look at a month and you look at a year, they can look very different. Try to use mathematical techniques to measure those and then aggregate them together. Let those approaches vote to create an overall signal. What this means is that in aggregate, we are trying to measure all the information and bring it together to give ourselves an overall view of where the market's going, because trend following is really just momentum trading across different assets. You're following where things are moving and you're adjusting as the world changes.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do, those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas,
begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Whenever there is a heightened state of volatility in the market, there's this tendency for analysts or market pundits who can't really explain what's going on to sort of point the finger at the machines running quant strategies. If not trend following, then volatility targeting and even risk parity, that sort of thing. And, you know, it's kind of an easy scapegoat, I guess, for some people to say, this market doesn't make any sense to anyone but a machine running the strategy. And the implication a lot of times is that quant strategies tend to do the same type of thing you're talking about, all sort of reacting, maybe reacting to different signals, but the end result being to sell or buy all at the same time and possibly exaggerate the moves in the market. Do you think that really happens in general, and specifically in say the volatility we've seen the last couple months, or is it just impossible to know and sort of impossible to dissect what is causing massive swings like that?
I always see, and I think it's an easy narrative to say that because it's easier to blame a machine than a person. But one other thing is that I always go back to the basic tenets of volatility. Volatility represents uncertainty. When things go up and down a lot, it's because people, whether or not it's an algorithm or a person, don't know what's going on. And they're unsure about where the markets are going. And I would say that across the quant space, it's actually been very mixed. Trend following strategies are one of the only strategies that have really tend to do very well in this environment. It actually turns out that a lot of the other quant strategies have struggled. The reason being is that they may have very specific hedges or offsets in strategies that when things get volatile, things get complicated for them. And so I would say that I tend to think about volatility is really our perception, or it's a measurement of our view of uncertainty. So the environment that we just went into, and you probably agree with me yourself, is that the idea of a pandemic, the idea of staying at home, the idea of a lockdown, is something so uncertain that it is not at all surprising to me that markets would be up and down every other day, because volatility is a measure of uncertainty. Things going around a lot is much more about how we feel about what things are worth. Now, could systematic managers or quant managers, when people do the same thing, move these things more? It's possible. I'd have to do a much more extensive research and really get into the data. I know that even when we looked at the flash crash, I know the CFTC did some extensive analysis of that and found actually that it was a fundamental trade that was just too large that created a dislocation. So I think that's a great question. It's definitely a good narrative. People like it, blame the machine. But for me, it's really, this volatility isn't someone's fault. It's more that we don't know. It's really representative of how unsure the markets are about what's going on.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that headlines, news flow has been on hyperdrive, it seems. And Mike, you know that has given us plenty of opportunities, at least, to think of crazy things for our crazy things
in markets. It's a bull market for crazy things in markets, for sure. So what's your best?
What has been shocking to me has been the contango in oil that we have seen. The fact that May oil prices were 19 and September 30 something. And I saw a report from Bloomberg today that people, so going back to what we saw bonds in the summer, where people are willing to pay to own German debt, now we have a situation where you get paid to sell gasoline. So maybe that's the next thing. We all go around and find gasoline and sell it, because that's a weird world that you could get paid to actually sell gasoline.
There must be just oil tankers crowded off the shores right now full of oil. That is an amazing situation.
Apparently, they said it was 12 cents a gallon in North Dakota for oil.
Wow.
Well, that's a good one, Katie. And you get props for sticking close to the markets. Sarah, can you top Katie's oil contango?
So I brought two, one that's markets related and one that's less so. So, but I'll start with the markets related one. And that's that. Now the five largest companies make up 19% of the S&P 500, which is a new record. And I think it's just been pretty amazing that we continue to see a lot of these mega cap technology and internet companies just continue to perform so well in this type of environment. I think like a couple years ago, people would have said that when the bull market came to an end, the companies that led on the way up were going to lead on the way down. And that certainly hasn't happened. So I think the fact that we have a new record related to top heaviness in the market is pretty crazy for one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then the less markets related one, really not related to the markets at all. There was just a great story in the New York Times. It was a bit, some would say humorous, but the headline reads, "Trump wanted a radio show, but he didn't want to compete with Limba." And it's a great read if you have some downtime. Essentially, it just details President Trump going to one of the coronavirus task force meetings and laying out this plan that he wanted to have a 2-hour radio show each day. And the only reason he didn't want to do it is because he didn't want to knock Rush Limbaugh's ratings. It's an interesting read. So it's just a bit humorous in these
instead
times.
He has a 2-hour TV show every night at the press conference.
Right. Now he has a TV show instead with great rating, so who would have known?
That's crazy times. I'm not sure how 2 hours on the radio helps him fight the virus, but he does like to talk, so I have no doubt he could fill 2 hours of radio time a day. All right, these are all pretty good. I'll give you mine. Mine, as you know, I like to push the boundaries of what is considered a market story, but this is certainly crazy. Now, one of the most depressing things about this virus for the average person who hasn't really had to deal with a sick or dying relative, but the lack of sports on TV throughout this has been traumatic for a lot of people, especially gamblers. And here's where we get into the markets. Now that online gambling is legal in some states, I think it's okay to consider that an official market. At least for the purposes of this crazy.
We have before.
Oh, yeah. At least for the purposes of this crazy observation. So the first major league sport to get back in business, do you know what it is? Well, not counting worldwide wrestling.
That's what I was going to say, WWE.
Okay. I guess that might be, there might be a tie between that. But you can't gamble on that. I mean, I guess you could. But if you're going to gamble on professional wrestling, then you've got
good luck.
You've got some major problems. But
only if you have inside information.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, those are all plans anyways, exactly. Right? They're all choreographed.
Just bet on the good guy, I guess. There is a league called the Major League Eating League. And it's these guys, you know, like at the hot dog eating contest on Coney Island. It's all those guys. It's been officially turned into a league called Major League Eating. And they believe they are the first professional sport to get back in business. They're having an eating tournament. Everyone's going to be at their home, Zooming in or Skyping in, I guess. And you'll be able to gamble on it. They've already set some of the over-unders and stuff like that on it. Let me just tell you what you have to do to participate in this tournament. So the qualifying round will consist of 2 pounds of sliced bologna. So you have to eat 2 pounds of sliced bologna, and it's a race. So who can eat that 2 pounds of bologna the fastest? I read somewhere the over-under was like 69 seconds for eating.
69 seconds?
To eat 2 pounds of bologna. So,
so Mike, you're not going to try to take part in this.
Maybe if it was, I don't know about bologna, the quarterfinals.
Maybe a hot dog.
Hot dogs, I don't know. I could kind of see that. If it was chicken wings, maybe I could get into yeah. that. I'm from Philly, where the big competition is the chicken wing eating competition. But so then from the quarterfinals, you'll have to eat a family sized pack of Oreos and a half a gallon of milk. That doesn't seem that tough, actually. But here's where
that's doable.
Yeah, here's where they really will separate the pros from the amateurs, though. To make it to the finals, you'll have to eat over a gallon of baked beans.
Oh.
And if you win that, the finals consists of 10 individual cups of ramen noodles. But I think that
I want to know who comes up with this stuff. Beans and ramen, what are they assuming more people have these things at their homes? Quarantining?
I wonder if that's it. Yeah.
Bologna?
Yeah.
Oreos?
The gallon of baked beans, I think, is the deal breaker there. I don't know. I pity the person who gets that far.
It's a hard one. I must say, I haven't been dragged into eating food watching yet, but I've been watching the horse tournaments for the NBA and the WNBA.
Oh,
and
yeah,
then
yeah,
also
yeah.
Yeah. been watching some NBA players playing 2K on Xbox, which has been a pretty entertaining in these times.
yeah, that's not bad. Hey, it beats watching a rerun of a game. Anyway, yeah. Katie, maybe you could get your pals at MIT. You could have like a New England clam chowder eating competition.
Why not? I think it's probably hard to get a hold of some fresh clam chowder around here. I don't know. Maybe there's a delivery service. To check if legal seafood delivers.
Yeah, they must be, right? Yeah, they, crazy.
All right, well, do what you got to do in these times. But on that note, anyways, Katie Kaminsky, thank you so much for joining the show this week.
Thank you so much for having me.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Ponsek, Mike is at Reganonymous, and you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.